All right, everyone. We are this week's Parshas Vayetze deals with Yaakov's journeying away from home and going to Haran and spending the next 20 years with his uncle Lavan, and chaos ensues. But we're going to go into a much broader theme tonight, which can be simply said in one simple sentence: why were the matriarch, or in Hebrew, the imahot, very beautiful women? Okay? We're talking about Sarah. We're talking Rivka. We're talking Rachel. The three matriarchs, not Leah, but the three out of four, were exquisitely beautiful women. Now, for guys, I mean, what's the, Rabbi, what's even the question? Okay. But we will get to the question, okay? We'll just keep that in abeyance here, all right? So,
We're talking about physical beauty.
Physical beauty. So you put in the vernacular, they were hot women. I'm just translating it to the men here for 2020, okay? That's what they were.
Well, they want people to be Jewish. They need to be carved.
All right, we're going to explore.
How hot are we talking here? Like from 1 to 10?
Well, we're going to see in the Torah, but you know yourself, in the Parsha of Lecha, so attractive that Paro's men says, this woman, Sarah, who was not young at this point, is so amazingly attractive, she's fit for a king. That level. I don't want to say the joke like Melania level. I don't want to say that level. I don't, you know. All right. We'll keep the jokes to the appropriate level. Okay. So, as we always do, we're going to go to the videotape, ladies and gentlemen. Here we go. All right. Okay, this is called 10 Trophy Wives Who Are Richer Than You Are.
Trophy wives live some of the most glamorous lives in the world. While it may not seem fair, there are millionaires and billionaires who can get any woman they want, and usually they're pretty gorgeous. Even if you have some cash in your pocket, these trophy wives can still outrun you by millions, if not billions. Before we get started, make your life richer by subscribing to The Richest. Click on that to one of our. Greco is married to Jeffrey Edelston, who is 46 years older than her. She's been married to the medical entrepreneur for a few years now. She has her own fashion line, and she's also a model and DJ. Edelston is known for his eccentric style, and he's worth about $100 million. Not only is Gabby filthy rich, but she's the stereotypical trophy wife with her good looks. Sean Southwick. While Sean Southwick may no longer be married to Larry King, she was the quintessential trophy spouse. She was King's eighth wife, and they were wed back in 1997. Given that he was already an adult when Sean was born, there was quite the age difference between the two, about 26 years. But just because King is so much older than Sean, he's definitely not settling for life. Amid their divorce proceedings, King was reportedly getting involved with Sean's younger sister. Hopefully, Sean got a cut of that $144 million she married into. Georgina Chapman. Georgina Chapman was definitely out of Harvey Weinstein's league. The gorgeous British fashion designer recently left her husband, and rumor has it that she's going to get about $12 million from the divorce settlement. Considering that Harvey has a net worth of about $150 million, that prenup agreement should be just a blip in his bank account. But as we know, Harvey is a disgusting human who owes people much more than money. Georgina is pushing forward, and the former trophy wife is proving she's a survivor. Kim Johnson. If you've ever watched Dancing with the Stars, then you know that Kim Johnson already has a dance career under her belt. She still counts as a trophy wife, though, as her husband, Robert Herjavec, is worth over $200 million. There's about...
All right, you get the basic idea. There's no end to this. All right. I think I made the point over here. All right, here we go. Question time. All right, Adrian is happy. I'm making all the guys happier tonight. All right, question number one. What is a trophy wife? Define it.
Beautiful. Like, way, way out of your league. Like, you're just there with your arm around the trophy.
Okay, an out-of-your-league beautiful woman. But that's okay, that's one part of it. Let's define a little bit more.
Are you asking about the characteristics, or are you asking about the psychological underpinning behind the definition?
Go ahead, give me the whole, I mean, that goes into my next question is, you can combine the question, you can combine the question with, I'll give you a second part of the question, and you give me a robust answer, which is, why do old rich men want them?
I was going to say that it's like arm candy kind of goes a little bit deeper in the sense that, you know, when you're a rich man and you go to galas and, you know, balls and you need someone on your arm that's going to make you look good, and it's a status symbol, like a sports car or a mansion or, you know, otherwise luxurious lifestyle, you have to have the arm
and
candy.
You forgot yacht and jet. Those two are also...
Say it again, what?
A yacht and a private jet.
Right, right. So you're saying that as the various symbols of wealth and power is all the beautiful amenities, a beautiful mansion, a jet, a yacht, a fleet of cars, etc., with wealth and power. And part of that projecting that wealth and power is the young, beautiful woman, model-esque woman, who reflects absolute beauty.
Rabbi, there's a difference, though. A regular trophy wife, right, an age-appropriate trophy wife, right, the woman can be more of a beauty in full sense than just an object.
Well, that's not really, in other words, typically, typically, hold on, what marriage is typically the classic trophy wife?
Depends on how you grew up and your social environment.
All right, one at a time. All right, Alan.
The older guy who's rich, dating a much younger, attractive woman. Does not matter if she's intelligent or not. She's just got to be like a bombshell.
She's got to be a bombshell. And typically, what number of marriage will this be for the old rich guy?
This is going to be number two and up. It could max out at like 10, like Larry King.
Right.
Or Hugh Hefner, who only got married once and then just had girlfriends.
Right. Probably a little smarter than Larry King. So, correct. These are not the first, these are not the regular marriages, or you want to call the starter marriages, where people got married to build a family, a more healthier marriage. These women are, there is an unspoken or might even be a spoken deal. What, Suzanne, let me invite you into this conversation here. What is the unspoken deal between all these women and all these men? You're on mute.
I don't want to say the women. I don't really know. I don't know a lot about these. I'm guilty of watching like The Real Housewives. And there was a trophy wife, but I heard she's getting divorced. So
well, they don't typically last. Also, there's another. It's another casualty of being the trophy wife.
But the wife spends, I hate to say it, they spend a lot of money and they do whatever, and the woman just kind of shows up when they need to.
Yes, correct. In other words, the woman will get to live in the lap of luxury, live with all the luxuries that she could possibly imagine, spend tremendous amounts of money, and she's there. Her role is to be there at the key moments, both the key moments publicly and the key moments privately. I'll use a little discretion. It's a Torah class, okay? But everybody here knows, okay? Are we all clear on that? That's the deal. Now, which gets us into a more universal question. I'm starting from the extreme, going back. What is the role of physical attraction in a healthy marriage?
To have kids.
Okay, you want to unpack that a little more there, Scott?
You know, to get in the mood, I guess.
You got to give me more than these one word answers here, Scott. You got to. What you're saying is true, but you want to unpack it a little more.
I was gonna say it's kind of like with babies. You know, babies are cute, and even though they, you have to kind of like take care of their, you know, eating and bathroom needs, and you have to deal with the screaming. Like, there's something there that forms an emotional bond, and it's kind of physically based. There's love is based on them being cute and adorable, and you want to keep going back to them.
And in a marriage,
the same principle applies.
Same principle, yeah.
In other words, that the foundation of a healthy marriage is first friendship, a respect and healthy friendship, but part of the glue of the relationship is there has to be a mutual attraction to want to be together physically, because as Scott said, first of all, A, you want to start a family, that's not going to work so readily if the partners are not attracted to each other.
Isn't that untrue in the ultra-Orthodox community, where people are set up and they typically only get to meet each other, you know, a couple times at most before their wedding?
That's still true because let me ask a question for the men in the audience here. How long does it take for a typical man to assess if a woman's attracted to him or not?
Well, the
how long? Answer the question.
The Rambam says
not very long.
Not very long. All right, 10 seconds.
The Rambam says you should like see the girl naked before you go.
No, does not say that. No, no, does not say that. No, does not. Never said that. Did not say that. No, no, no. Do not put evil words into the mouth of the Rambam. That is wrong on many levels. Okay. All right, but yes, he's got it. What he did say, he has to be able. He has to, when people are dating, they have to see if they're attracted to each other. Now, the Hasidic community, they cut it down to the, shall we say, the bare minimum, okay, which is 3-4, at most 10 dates, sometimes could be 2 dates, whatever. That's the most minimalistic, and in the modern Orthodox, it could be 2 years, which is also radically unnecessary.
Rabbi, the most minimalistic I've heard in the Hasidic community is a certain grand rabbi's son to a certain grand rabbi's daughter. They literally, just to fulfill the words of the Rambam based on the parasha, they just walked. They walked down the hall and said mazel tov to each other.
All right, so that could be true or could be apocryphal, but because you're not doing anybody any favors if the couple is not attracted to each other, you're just going to start the marriage off with discord. That's a disaster. That's not wise. I'm not saying, I'm saying
that's not the norm.
I understand that. So let's don't deal with crazy cases. Let's deal with the normal cases. The normal cases, that's part of going out, part of dating is that component, is to see if the couple are attracted on a physical level and on an emotional level, and do they have common goals and, all these different elements. Now, going back to our original case of the trophy wife, how long do trophy marriages typically last? I don't have a stat, but give me a sense.
2 to 7 years. So, sometimes if the guy is so old,
the guy dies.
right. So, 90. Right. Sometimes the, right. So the woman's going to hang on. Adrian's quoting the pasuk, but that does not mean, to inspect her does not mean her naked. That's to look at her to see if she's attractive. Learn some Hebrew, dude. All right. That's a mistranslation. He has to look at her to see if he's attracted. That does not mean he has to see her naked. That's wrong. Okay, we go on. We're moving on. All right. So the trophy marriages are by definition typically second marriage or third marriages, which by definition don't last that long intrinsically. The divorce rate increases dramatically America, the first marriage, the divorce rate of the first marriage between 30 to 35%. Second marriage is 50 to 60%. Third marriage is like 100, it increases it like 150%. Just in, you know, more than a doubling of the chance of a divorce. Okay? So, they're not built to last. Now, let me ask you this question. Why is that? Why don't these marriages last? Some people last, they endure it because they want the big payoff. They'll be in a, you know, they could be in a marriage which is, you know, it could
be different goals to start with. I mean, one is trying to get very wealthy very quick.
Yes.
And live a certain lifestyle, and the other one's just trying to have someone to show off.
Yeah, so why will it not, why, you know, for example, with Larry King being the most extreme example, had 10 of these wives, he had like about 8 of these trophy wives. What's the idea?
I also think it's a concept.
All right, well, we're going to go to Alan. Alan in New York.
I just feel like it's a concept of youth. Like, they have these young women around them, and it makes them feel younger because they're more active and wanting to do it. They generally don't have kids. Their kids are already grown up. So they're doing fun stuff with, you know, a younger person, and it makes them feel young. I mean, I feel like a lot of these billionaires and wealthy guys, you know, have that desire to stay young and relevant, and having a trophy wife does that for them.
Right, so that's part of the rush of the experience. Well, not to mention, let's be honest, having physical relations with a gorgeous model is obviously an intrinsic benefit in its own right. Hey, I'm not
sure if Larry King can.
If he can, correct. But why? So why will it end? Why will it end?
What was the question?
Why do these trophy wife marriages end? As we, if you're ever standing online in the grocery store and pick up a People magazine, you will read about a trophy wife marriage that ended.
Yeah.
All right, Suzanne, raising her hand.
Because I'll tell you, to quote the great Judge Judy, beauty fades and dumb is forever. And not to say that it means that they're dumb, but when you're just looking at them very shallow, at the end of the day, they may be like, oh my goodness, what did I get myself into? It's like talking to a rock, or we have nothing in common, or we don't share any of the same core values, but they're really nice to look at and carry around.
Correct. No, because the bottom line is that when you are a multimillionaire and a billionaire, these people tire of all their physical things. They get a new suit, a new car, a new house, a new yacht, a new plane. In other words, it becomes old and tired. So therefore, the woman is part of the physical apparatus of his empire. And it, just like Ahasuerus, how many wives did Ahasuerus have after Vashti? Literally thousands. Because, you know, the fantasy wears off, moving on. That's it. If your criteria is only physical beauty, it wears off, there is sexual boredom, he's moving on. Divorce ensues. And that's it. If you don't have anything else other than that, it's not going to last. All right. Now, let's get into the next point. What does the Torah or the Tanakh have to say about the virtue of physical beauty? And I'll give you a hint. It is said at many tables on Friday night. It is part of Eishes Chayil. That is part of the 31st chapter of the book of Proverbs, Mishlei. What element? I'm going to now do the share screen. All right, it's the last couple of sentences. Who wants to read it out? Who's any volunteers to read? Sean, read it out. Read the Hebrew.
The Hebrew?
Yeah, come on.
Sheker, Hachain.
Yep.
Behevel, Agafi, Isha, Yeriat. Yeah.
No, that's Yirat Hashem.
Yeah, Hashem, He, Titalal.
Correct. Sheker Achein Vehevela Yofi Isha Yiras Hashem Hitis Alal, which translate, grace is deceptive, beauty is illusory, for it is the fear of the Lord that a woman is to be praised. Okay? So the Tanakh clearly says, very openly, that pure physical beauty is hevel, is nothingness, is superficial. Okay? So the Torah, on the surface, King Solomon, when he wrote the book of Mishle, is saying that that's not, rather, what is a value, her eternal value, her love, her fear of God. Okay? So clearly, the Torah is not endorsing physical beauty as an end in its own right. There's an indictment of physical beauty as an end in its own right. And that said, sung to, you know, I'll just sing it, because everybody, Sheker Achein Vehevel Ayofi Isha Yiras Hashem Hitis Halal. Everybody's heard that before, right? Every MG Shabbaton, we're singing that. And you'll go to many Shabbos, God willing, you'll be able to go to people's homes for a Shabbos meal, you know, without fear of making it a COVID super spreader experience. You will hear that song being sung in many a Shabbos table throughout the world. Okay, so so this point is reinforced every Friday night. Now, to bring it on the male perspective, because we talked about the female, let's go on to the next story. Let me call upon Brooke, also this year's fellowship class. Read out from, this is for the book of Samuel. Read it from Hashem.
Hashem sends the prophet Samuel to anoint one of Yishai's sons as the next king of Israel.
Go on.
When they arrived and he saw Eliab, he thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, pay no attention to his appearance or his stature, for I have rejected him. For not as man sees does the Lord see. Man sees only what is visible, but the Lord sees into the heart.
Okay, so King, the prophet Samuel, the Hebrew, Shmuel, is sent into a mission. He goes to Beit Lechem, goes to Bethlehem, right? And his job is to anoint the next king of Israel, the first king of Israel, King Saul. And the next, who's the second king of Israel?
David.
Melissa, thank you so much. But he doesn't know. Hashem does not tell him. He goes in there, and there's six brothers, and he sees the first guy, Eliab, and he looks majestic. He looks like a king. He has, you know, he has charisma. He has a presence. He's good looking. He's the guy. So Samuel the prophet says, oh, this has got to be the guy. And he goes there, and Hashem communicates, says, no. That's not the guy. He's not the oldest one. And he says, because God does not pay attention to his, man sees what's visible to his eyes, but the Lord sees in the heart. In other words, God can give an absolute and true assessment of the person, which is not his physical features. Okay? So I'm just bringing this down, as clearly these are two instances where assessment and valuing of physical beauty per se is what? Repudiated. Okay? Now we're going to have the thesis. Now we're going to have the antithesis here for a moment here. Now we're going to do a little run through the parshiot of the last couple of weeks. Here we go. Let's talk about Sarah. Let me have... Dan, can you read this? Dan Lasman?
Sorry, I can't read right now.
Okay, no problem. All right, I'm going to go... Who can volunteer? All right, Scott, read it out.
Sarah. When Abraham came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that his wife was very beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and spoke highly to her, to the Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's palace.
Okay, so number one, it's not simply that Sarah, Avram's wife, was attractive. It wasn't that she was simply good looking. She was so attractive. Now, roughly, her age is 65 years old. Okay, now, exactly, all right? So this is the middle-aged woman who was so amazing that she gets abducted into the king of Egypt's harem. So how attractive is that on the attractive-o-meter? You got to admit that's a full 10. That's a full 10. So put it in very simple male vernacular, Sarah was a 10. Okay? But it didn't, I mean, okay? So let's gather the facts. Number, that's Sarah. That's our first matriarch, our first one of the Imaot, okay? Let's keep on going. I turn to Sean. Let's read about Rivka. Rebecca, go on.
He had not yet finished speaking when Rivka appeared. She had been born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. Her jug was on her shoulder. The girl was extremely good-looking, and she was a virgin, untouched by any man. The girl went down, filled her jug, and then came up again.
So the Torah here is giving a lot of bit, you know, it's giving, shall we say, a little bit undue focus here upon she's not just attractive, she's extremely attractive. Again, second one of the Imahot. What number do we give her? She's a 10. We keep on going.
You got to see the scene, like with her hair moving as she picks up.
All right, slow down there. Oh, slow down, Adrian. All right. Sometimes
can getting water from the well be a metaphor for, you know, learning Torah, that she was very
no
deep in the ways of the Torah now?
No. And later on, Yitzhak had the same problem, because when Yitzhak ultimately married Rebecca, and they have to, because of the famine, go to the area of Gerar, they have to do the exact same ruse. Let's act as a brother and sister, and therefore I will not get killed. In other words, so it's a real big liability. That, in other words, how attractive was she? Her attraction, her attractiveness was a liability. That's, again, she's extremely hot in using the vernacular. Okay, Rachel, Rachel, let's go to Chaim Fishoff in Far Rockaway, New York.
Laban had two daughters. The older one's name was Leah, and the younger one's name was Rachel. Leah had lovely eyes, while Rachel was shapely and beautiful.
Hello. Okay.
That's so, a very polite way.
Right. So the Hebrew is Yifat Toar V'Yifat Mareh. Yifat Toar means like the general overall shape. Okay. And we don't have to go. And then there's the Mareh, is the actual her features of her face. So she was like a model-esque person. And the Torah records that information. So the question which I'm obviously curating over here is question number six. If physical beauty is not a virtue, why are the wives of the patriarchs so very amazingly beautiful? I mean, in other words, they're not just attractive; they're like world class, world renowned, ridiculously off the chart beautiful. And the Torah, this seems to contradict with the Torah. I mean, if we just if it's sheker achein vehevel ayofi, if we're supposed to view it that physical attractiveness per se as a value, as a virtue, is an illusion, is a falsehood, is not a virtue, then why does the Torah go out of its way to mention? In other words, don't even let us know about it. It's none of our business. Why do I have to know what Avram's wife looked like? Why is that my concern? Okay. Why do I need to know what Rivka's wife, what Isaac's wife looked like? None of my business. Okay, why is, even, let's say she was as attractive. Why does even Torah mention it? You know what I'm saying? I think that's a strong question. Before I go on, would you agree that's a fairly strong question? I'm getting a one head shake.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Question number seven. I'm going to get back. We're going to answer that question, but I'm not going to answer it right now. Question number seven. If the patriarchs were prophets and thus the most perfected men who walked the earth, why are they all married to these model level looking wives? It's a variation of question number of the previous one. In other words, we're not talking about regular people. We say in our Amidah, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. What does that even mean? It means that when I'm saying the Amidah, I say, "Blessed are you, God, God of our forefathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob." I'm saying that I'm relating to, I am viewing myself as I am standing before God as conceived, as best conceived by Abraham, by Isaac, and by Jacob. Okay? They were our philosophical fathers. They brought this idea to God, to both Jew and non-Jew alike. So these are very special people. And they're prophets, which means we identify a prophet as not just a guy that Hashem speaks to, but a person who is on a remarkably high level of ethical perfection, of philosophical perfection, of moral perfection. And yet, it's a little bit strange that the Torah is talking about that they are married to, you know, amazingly attractive women. What's going on here? There's something very strange going on.
Just to add a footnote.
Yes.
Another similarity between them all, correct me if I'm wrong, is they were all barren, right? They all had problems.
Ooh, good question, Sean. Yes,
perfect.
Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel, all three of them were barren. All, you know, for decades. Yes, that's also very significant. But that's so significant, that's actually a shear in its own right. That's another question of, why were all the matriarchs barren? But I can only do only one topic per class. Tonight is, why were all the matriarchs good looking? Which I think people find more appealing.
That's why I said a footnote to the whole story.
Right. If I can squeeze that in. No, that, I can't squeeze it. That's literally a whole class. I don't even remember. Have I discussed that in any of the classes? I turned to Sean and Suzanne, who have been starting their sixth cycle of the Parsha class. I don't even remember at this point.
I certainly don't remember it.
It's come up, but there's not. I don't think there's been an actual
whole class. Okay, I'm going to jot that. Hold on. I'm going to jot. Jotting that down because I need. I'm looking for fresh ideas here. Hold on. I can't repeat any of the material because I got the same people for 6 years straight here. Hold on. That's a good one. All right, that's a good shear. Okay.
Actually, Shane and I talked about this last week, actually.
Well, not with me, it didn't.
The certain shear that you have to put the same or the similar themes because it's an important theme or video. Like we saw the Rav Goren Wednesday night, we saw the Rav Goren video.
Right. That's such a good video. I will on occasion show a very good video like twice. That's true. Because that's true.
Good stuff. Chazara is important.
Is there anything about what the patriarchs looked? Were they
no men
looking?
First of all, Suzanne, that's an outstanding question.
And the answer, 1 second, and I was going to say this before, but it didn't.
Hold on, let me answer a question.
It does talk about their money.
Oh, okay. First, that's another quick question. Yet, at all periods of time, it's another point, which I think I'll tie it in, Chaim, tie it in. So, Suzanne, excellent question. It does not mention what Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob looked like at all. Other than we know that Yaakov was a smooth-skinned person, and his twin brother was a hairy-skinned person. Other than the facial hair component, we do not know what.
We do know that he picked up the rock for the well.
Yes, in the least partial, he is very strong. Okay, so we know that he's strong and not hairy, but that's not enough to give you a clear sense.
And not a good businessman.
Okay, and did not do well. We'll get to that, and we'll also get to that in another class. So,
the only male who's mentioned for appearance is Yosef.
Ah! Marvin Baum! Ladies and gentlemen, Marvin Baum, second fellowship class.
Marvin!
Right. It says, by the way, by Marvin is on point, but it's not this week's Parsha. It's a couple of Parshas in the future.
Where it also says he looked like his grandfather's face.
It says, doesn't say that, it just says the same term by Rachel that Yifat Toar Yifat Mareh, good of form and good of looks, good of shapely and beautiful, that Yosef was also shapely and beautiful. In other words, he was a strikingly good-looking man. Now, the Torah tells us that because that's critical for the story with Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. Okay, so that's that episode. Chaim, remind me so I don't forget. I will also answer, which is a second choice for the title of tonight, but not as appealing, is why were all the patriarchs very wealthy? True, good question, not as appealing. But I'm going to answer that question as well. Okay? It's a two for one. In other words, one of my students, Samantha Grossman, and if she's listening, hat tip to you. Samantha Gross said to me, Rabbi, she taught me something very powerful early on. She said, Rabbi, titles matter. Titles matter. So I have taken that advice to heart from Samantha. So that's why I picked this title. Okay, we move on. All right. So I want to...
I thought you were talking about rabbis or VP or CEO.
Not titles.
I got it.
Titles matter. Class titles matter, right.
The marketing of the class.
Right, yes. Okay.
Rabbi Ezra is the king for that because he gives the same class five different times a year with just different titles.
that's an art. Okay, here we go. So I want to explore how did Avram relate to Sarah's beauty, okay? We've already established clearly that she's so beautiful that Paro must have her, okay? That's how beautiful she was. We've established that, okay? So let me turn to Suzanne. Read out the psukim here from chapter 12, 10.
There was a famine in the land. Avram headed south to Egypt to stay there for a while since the famine had grown very severe in the land. As they approached Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarai, I realize that you are a good-looking woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will assume that you are my wife and kill me, allowing you to live.
Okay. So we have a very brief exchange over here that the Torah quotes. How did Avram relate to Sarah's beauty?
It was a negative, almost a liability.
It was a liability. Now, when he says the phrase, I realize that you are a good-looking woman. Why is he saying that? Is that weird?
It's very weird.
Okay, so break it down. What's specifically weird about that?
You don't mention the obvious. Like, if your wife is beautiful, you don't say, I realize that you're beautiful.
Right.
That you realized.
Right, so I'm just going to quote the Hebrew. Ataya dati ki isha yifat mareat. I realize. What does that imply? That for him, what deduction must you make? How did you relate to her beauty?
That it wasn't a primary concern or a primary reason why he valued her.
Exactly. The only reason he's bringing it up is because he knows he's going into to Egypt, which apparently was renowned for its sexual immorality. And now his wife, which happens to be very attractive, is now in, this is actually going to be a profound liability, as Adrian pointed out. And so much so that they might kill me because they need her single. They will singleify her by killing me, putting my feet into concrete and sending me down to the bottom of the Nile, right? So he's not like he look. I realize, in other words, it's not it's not primary in his mind that she's that's not her. That's not her essential quality. And just the opposite, the fact that she's so attractive is actually what? A negative. Okay? Let's keep on going.
Wouldn't most wives be upset if their husbands don't mention, oh, you're so beautiful at some point in the marriage?
It doesn't mean that he never said to her in as a healthy marriage, you're a beautiful woman. But you see, the way that in that offhand comment, that for him, that was not her main feature. Now, for the trophy wife relationship, the woman being a model is critical. In other words, by the way, just for a moment, it's extremely, that, just to step into a shoes for a moment, just to step into those high heel shoes for a moment, it is not easy to be a trophy wife. Why is it not easy to be a trophy wife? Tremendous. All right, Scott.
Well, because like you're held to this like high standard. You can't go like, you know.
You can't be gaining 20 pounds.
Right.
You can't be gaining 20 ounces.
You can't relax and like sweats like a.
No, you gotta be. You gotta be a trophy. You gotta be all kind shiny.
You're not seen for anything beyond your beauty, which is.
And you also can't, like, right, you can't, what you were saying, like, you can't, like, people won't, like, come to you for your opinion. Like,
right, you're right, like, right.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Right, that's another defect. In other words, you're not any other virtue that you may possess, you're not being validated by that.
Like, you have a really good mind for business, but, like, they won't,
Or the opposite. They ask you for your opinion when the only thing you are is beautiful.
Correct.
But you happen to be the president's wife now. You happen to be the first lady, for example, just as a hypothetical.
Right.
And then you got to answer like some deeper questions, and you're like, I'm just beautiful. Like, I didn't sign up.
All right. Without bringing Melania Trump into the sheer, but the point being is it's extremely stressful because basically you always have to be essentially, you know, red carpet beautiful all the darn time. That's sort of like a double-edged sword. So, yeah, you get private planes, mansions, exotic vacations, limitless, you know, credit cards to spend, but you have a tremendous stress. You got to be all kinds of physically amazing all the time. Okay? So, Avram happened to be married to a woman who was that beautiful, but it was that element did not seem to be very compelling. Let me double down on this. Let's go to, he's giving, fast forward. Avram is instructing his servant, which we call, his name is Eliezer, to go to the family in Aram Naharaim, up in Syria, and to get a wife for Isaac, okay? Alan, can you read?
Abraham was old, well advanced in his years, and Hashem had blessed Abraham with everything. He said to the senior servant of his household, who was in charge of all that he owned, "Place your hand under my thigh. I will bind you by an oath to Hashem, Lord of heaven and earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. Instead, you must go into my native land, to my birthplace, obtain a wife for my son, Yitzchak."
Okay, so what criteria for marriage is important to Avram for his son, Yitzchak?
Someone with a pulse and that is not a Canaanite.
Not just a pulse, but very specifically two features, two qualities are mentioned. And we have to ask what those qualities are, what they reduce down to. What two qualities is Avram looking for in a wife for Yitzchak?
Part of the extended family.
Part of the family. And two, in other words, there's a removal of a negative. I do not want a woman who's a Canaanite, and I want a positive, is a member of my family. The question, of course, is why? Why? What's wrong with the Canaanites?
Idol worshippers.
Right, so Avram's whole mission is to battle idolatry. His family, either they're not idolaters or they're more predisposed to his ideas. So, essentially, what he's looking for Yitzchak is a woman who will be his philosophical partner, someone who will continue the building of the Abrahamic nation, somebody who will build the civilization with Yitzchak. What is not mentioned in his list? And remember, as Chaim pointed out, Avram was loaded, wealthy, very wealthy. What he could add a couple more items on the list. I mean, people on the Upper West Side have a list a little longer than this, okay, of things that they must have. What did he not mention?
Looks.
Thank you, Marvin. Appreciate that. Okay, now we're gonna zero in to the play by play of when Eliezer, who's the senior servant of Avram's household, actually gets to Aram Naharaim. He shows up and he's got to deliver the goods. What's his play by play? I'm gonna turn to Brooke. Read it out.
Wait, just curious. Wait. Yeah. Did Avram know that his son Yitzchak's eyes were going anyways?
At this point, Yitzchak's eyes were not going because he was...
Why? Was he after the Akedah, right?
That's a Midrash. The plain reading is that his eyes grew dim because he was well over 100 years old by the time he gave the blessings to Esav and Yaakov. Which you mentioned is a Midrash. Actually, Rashi brings down three Midrash, and that's the third. Okay, let's go on.
I meant it as a joke, but thank you for...
Okay, no, that was a serious question. Okay. All right, let's keep on going. All right, Brooke, read it out. 24:14.
If I say to a girl, tip over your jug and let me have a drink, and she replies, drink, and I will also water your camels, she is the one whom you have designated for your servant, Isaac. If there is such a girl, I will know that you have granted a favor for my master.
Okay, so what criteria is important to Avram's servant in selecting a wife for Rivka?
Compassion, caretaking,
kindness, generosity. In other words, the virtues of what we call Hashem's virtues: compassion, mercy, kindness, taking care of people who are in need. In other words, he was looking for a virtuous person, and basically that was the criteria. He didn't say the hottest chick that shows up to the well, I'm going to flaunt the cash, and I'm going to get her to be the wife of my master's son, Yitzchak. Did not mention that at all. Now, we read before, it happened to be that Rivka was very attractive. But basically, the criteria, he was not interested in a beauty pageant criteria. He was looking at 100% midos qualities, eternal qualities, and B, coming from the right family, which means that they had the values and virtues of Abraham. We go to Scott Shapiro in Philadelphia.
Why didn't he send his son himself? Why did he send a servant?
Excellent question. That is such a good question. That's an entire class in his own right.
So, all right, you write it down. Don't forget.
Okay, we'll put that down. Okay, good question. All right, we continue. We can't have what they call the super shear, the shear to end all shearim. No, we got to focus here. Now, let's fast forward to the next family, okay? Let's see what Yitzchak and Rivka's criteria to marrying off their kids is. Let me turn to Sean. Sean, 27:46, Rivka said to Isaac.
Rivka said to Yitzchak, I'm disgusted with life because of those Hittite women. If Yaakov marries such a Hittite girl from the daughters of this land, why should I go on living? Yitzchak summoned Yaakov and said to, and gave him a blessing and a charge. Do not marry a Canaanite girl, he said. Set out and go to Padan Aram, to the house of your maternal grandfather, Bethuel. marry a daughter of your uncle Lavan.
Okay, here we go again. So what criteria is important to Rivka and Yitzchak for selecting a wife for Yaakov? What did she say? In other words, she's disgusted that her other son, Esav, married two local gals, two Hittite women. Okay, and it says, if she basically says to Yitzchak, it says earlier that it was Morat Ruach. It was like, it was so stressful, such a negative experience. It was literally life-shortening for them. It was, okay? What was the problem with the Hittite women? I'm sure they're lovely. What was the problem with the Hittite women? Anybody know? Yeah, they're idolaters. So, but here we have Yitzchak who's trying to continue on the ideas and the values and virtues and teach the people about Hashem. And in his own living room is these two Hittite women who are fundamentally, say, you know, the equivalent of, you know, they're eating pork and, you know, they got, they got a cross or whatever, you know, the equivalent of an idolatrous, instinctual, hedonistic point because their son Esav, shall we say, is not fully bought on to the whole program. He's what they call a little bit off the derech, okay? So his women are reflective of that ambivalence. And Rivka says, if my son Yaakov does the same thing, I can't go on. So clearly, what she doesn't say is that it must be that Yaakov marries the most beautiful women that we can find in the entire Near East. She never says that. She wants a woman who will follow the values of her and her husband, Isaac. Okay?
But wasn't Lavan an idolater?
It doesn't say openly, but he does say, Bo Baruch Hashem. Come, bless his God. Now, we don't know if he was like, he could be, it's hard to know, he could be, well, we know he's idolatrous at the end. But he could be what is not so uncommon. He's like a person who is conflicted. He has a part of him who's Abrahamic. He was schooled in that. He says, Bo Baruch Hashem, come blessed of God, uses Hashem's name. On the other hand, you know, he's playing both sides of the fence. He's basically what they call an American Jew. I'm Jewish, but I'm American. And sometimes I'm more American, and sometimes I'm more Jewish. It depends on the day, okay? We know Lavan. Loving is, we all got a little loving in us, okay? So that's, loving is a complicated person, and he's like us. All right, let's go on. Then we get to our scene over here. Loving says to Yaakov, just because you are a kinsman, a relative, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what will your wages be? Now, Loving had two daughters. The name of the old one was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. And as we read, Leah had weak eyes. I don't know, some sort of disease or whatever it was. And Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Yaakov loved Rachel. So he answered, I will serve the 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Lavan said, better I give her to you than I give her to an outsider. Stay with me. So Yaakov served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed him but a few days because of her love for her. Okay, let's do some interesting math over here. How old was Yaakov when he got married, roughly? Just doing the math in reverse, Yaakov was 130 years old when he got down to Egypt. Yosef, his youngest son, next to the youngest son, was 39 years. And Yaakov spent 20 years with Laban. So roughly, give me a decade. How old is Yaakov when he's showing up to Laban's house? Work out the math here, guys. Work backwards.
Is it 110?
No, if he's 130 when he shows up to Egypt, and Yosef is the second in command of thing, and he's 39, so deduct 39 years, that takes him to 91. He was, how many years was he in Lavan's house, 20 years. So deduct another 20 years, 71. So he had maybe a little later. So maybe he's like, so he's around, he's like 70 years old, roughly. In his late 60s, early 70s. I don't know exactly, all right? The dude's not a spring chicken over here. Okay? So why did he not get married earlier? And hint, his brother, Esav, married to two Hittite women when he was 40 years old. So his brother, his twin brother, Esav, married at 40. Dude's in his 60s, nothing's doing. What's going on? He has the Shidduch crisis. What's going on? So he says, the Torah describes Yaakov as being what? Dweller of tents. What does that tell us?
Studying.
What?
He was studying.
Studying, correct. So Unkla says he wasn't literally living in a tent because people living in the Near East in that time, many people lived in tents. He was in the tents. The Midrash says, and Unkla says, the tents of study. So fundamentally, he was committed to involved in Jewish study, which is the values and virtues and philosophies of Avram. So he was focused on that. He was very studious. So he pushed off getting married. Now, how important, now we get started, we got three questions left for the night here. How important was Rachel looks to Yaakov? Okay? What do you say?
Very important.
How do you know? What's your evidence, Marvin?
He was attracted to her right away, and he was not attracted to the sister, and Laban knew that, and that's why Laban did a switcheroo at the last minute with the veil.
All right, so let's take it step by step. His father says, marry a daughter of Lavan. Lavan had two daughters. Option one, Leah. Option two, Rachel. Seemingly, it says, boom, she's the most attractive one. He loved Rachel, as Marv is suggesting, seemingly either the most important criteria or an important criteria is the fact that she's very good looking. Okay?
And you wouldn't say maybe the opposite of, like, remember, he didn't know he was going to get both right away, right? He didn't, so maybe it wasn't so important, because if not, he would have protested.
No, but right now he thinks he's made a deal.
He
made a deal. I'm working 7 years. We call it now. I don't got cash. I can provide sweat equity. I will work for 7 years for the right to marry your younger daughter, Rachel. Now
Do you learn in Pshat that he actually was tricked?
Yeah, he was tricked. Totally tricked. I mean, that's what it says, and that's why the next morning, which is another shear, how Yaakov got tricked, the next morning he goes to him, how come you tricked me? That would imply that he felt tricked, okay? Now, so, what is paradoxical about Yaakov's 7 years of working for Rachel was like a few days? He says that him working for 7 years was like a few days.
I mean, he was still in his late, 70s?
60s, whatever. 67, right? Yeah. So why was it like a few days?
Because he was so excited and looking forward to it, it went right like that.
Now, let me ask you a question. Anybody who's met somebody who is engaged to get married, right? If a person is engaged to get married, let's say a person get married in 3 months. Is that something that goes quickly or goes slowly?
Goes quickly. If you're all excited, you're planning for your future, everything seems to be a whirlwind.
No, it retrospectively, it seems like a whirlwind. But if you wanna live together as husband and wife, and you can't because you're waiting for the wedding day, then it's like the clock is going very, very slowly. It's a tremendous frustration because you can't have your desire realized. So the fact that for Yaakov that the 7 years, which is not a short amount of time, went like it was like a few days to him, implies that he was not feeling very frustrated. Which means that his interest with her, yes, was he attracted to her? Yes, he was. Were there other elements? Yes, there were. She was the right girl. He may no doubt had doesn't tell us, but he may have saw that she is a great woman. So the fact that he's not frustrated by having to wait for 7 years is indicative that his primary focus is not his sexual infatuation with the beautiful Rachel. Because otherwise, if he wants to be with a woman and you can't, and you got to wait 7 years, that is going to be very painful. Okay? All right? So now I'm going to answer the question of the night is why were the matriarchs very beautiful women? I'm making the following case. The Torah, the Tanakh seems to make the case that one, that beauty per se is not a virtue. It's sheker. It's falsehood. It's a lie. And we see that when the patriarchs are looking to get people married in their family, they don't mention attraction, beauty as being a criteria at all. So then why did the Torah go out of its way to mention the beauty? The reality is, it goes back to, it plays an instrumental goal. You have to go back is what was the mission of Abraham and Sarah? What was the mission of Isaac and Rebekah? What was the mission of Jacob and Rachel? Their mission was to, as the verse says, Vayikra b'shem Hashem kel olam. And Abraham called out in the name of the Lord, the King of the universe, Master of the universe. So they're there to teach an idolatrous world that there is Hashem, and He's the cause of all existence. And there's a way to relate to Hashem. And there's a way to act with justice and kindness and inviting guests over, hachnasat orchim. They're bringing this revolution of morality to the world. So what did Hashem gift them? What do people like? People like beauty, and people respect beauty, and people respect money. What did Avram and Sarah have? They had beauty. She had the beauty. He had the money. What did Yitzchak have? He had the money. What did Rivka have? She had the beauty. Yaakov later on, had the money, and she had the beauty. In other words, and it's the same idea we see that by in the, this is actually codified, that in the time of the temple, we have the high priest called the Kohen Gadol. He has to be physically beautiful, attractive man. And he has to be wealthy. And if he's not wealthy, all the Kohanim have to chip in and make him wealthy. Why? Because the Torah is realistic of where people are at. In order for Avram and Sarah to be an effective outreach couple, they need to be attractive. They need to be pleasing to the eye. They need to be what people view as immediately very appealing. You know what I'm saying? Just to give an analogy, we've ended the presidential election season. Let me take you back to 1960, 1961, when President John F. Kennedy and his wife Jacqueline Onassis Kennedy stood there in the inauguration, I think January 1961. What did the world see? What did the world celebrate? What did Life magazine celebrate back then? You've seen the documentaries. Camelot. What?
Camelot.
Camelot.
With lots of money from the Joseph Kennedy family and the beautiful younger wife of that senator from a family with lots of money.
Marvin Baum, 1,000% correct. In other words, people were enamored. First of all, JFK was, by all accounts, a good-looking man. Nobody could rock this Ray-Bans like John F. Kennedy. I am sorry. Okay? That was a good-looking man. And Jackie Onassis Kennedy, a model. And so therefore, now, on top of that, he had very sophisticated ideas. He's a smart person. He shared a great speaker. He had many good virtues. But all those virtues were accelerated because not only do they have what to share, But the packaging, the marketing of them was unbelievable. They were like unstoppable couple. Tragically cut short. You know what I mean? He would have been likely a two-term president. I mean, we don't know. Because, A, very smart, very charismatic, very thoughtful, lot to offer, and amazingly good-looking. Okay? Looks matter in the sense of mass appeal.
Right, so, but he was a horrible president.
So I don't want to assess whether he was a good president or bad president. I want to say that his appeal as a president and the fact that his the memory, you know, he's on his he's commemorated on bridges and other many, many things all over the world. Now, but one thing I think is whether you're Democrat or Republican, clearly good-looking man, good-looking wife, a big part of your appeal. So if a person wants to be dismissive of his thing, you'll say he was all packaging and no content. And if you're going to take a more of a Democratic perspective, he was the full package. He had the content and the full thing.
Vietnam, Bay of Pigs.
Like. Right. Okay. Yeah. I will also say it's not easy to be the president. So you're right. So there's that's a good question. Whether or not was JFK an excellent good president. But one thing is clear. He is one of the most beloved presidents. In fact, but it's got a lot to do with the fact that he just looks the damn part. So it was very important that. Say it again.
That he was assassinated and cut down at the so-called prime of his life, of course.
Right. He becomes like a martyr figure on top of that. So my point being is that, to answer the question, why did God, or why was it critical that Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel be extremely good-looking? Not because it's a value or virtue in its own right, because it was critical for their mission to as they're starting out Judaism in its formative years, that in order to have an impact in the world, it needed the external marketing element that people would, in other words, if somebody's good looking, they just, people want to hang out with them and listen to them a little bit more. You know what I'm saying? And conversely, going back to Chaim's point, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, for big parts of life, were wealthy. That people respect wealth. That's it. If you're Warren Buffett,
Jared Ivanka is a good thing for the Jews, you're saying.
Well, again, it's not an intrinsic good; it's an instrumental good. If you have these questions, these qualities, what do you do with them? It's not a virtue in its own right. My key point is it's an instrumental value, which to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov was not that important. I don't want to say, by the way, I don't want to go to the other extreme. I'm not saying that Yaakov did not appreciate her beauty, but that wasn't how he looked at her essentially. He did not look at her as a trophy wife. Gorgeous woman. She was gorgeous, but that was not a critical feature in his appeal to her. As the fact that he, otherwise it would have killed him to have to wait for 7 years to be with her. Okay? So that, questions. All right, Adrian.
Would you say then that it's a Torah value to try to make yourself as visually appealing and rich as possible? I mean, what's the normative lesson?
No. Here? So the normative lesson is like this. So bring it down to our level. Thank you, Adrian. Is that it's critical for a husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, to be attracted to each other, because that has an instrumental good to be able to have a healthy, warm relationship. And actually, it's codified in Jewish law that a husband and wife has to be concerned about how they present themselves to each other. They have to make an effort to be appealing with each other. You know what I'm saying? You can't what they call in the vernacular, let yourself go. You have a responsibility. You have a responsibility to your spouse to be appealing.
What about to the world? Because this whole shiur was about appealing to the masses, not to each other.
Well, no, because I'm saying is that we don't have the job. No, our job is not to convert the world. Our job is to be able to be a presentable, clean, neat person who, let's say, in your world, let's say you're in your workplace, that you represent Judaism properly. So that means you are, you look like a, to use the simple Yiddish phrase, you look like a mensch, and more importantly, you act like a mensch. Okay, but I'm trying to explain the extreme element of why Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel had to be model level good looking, I mean, that seems to be extreme, and for them, it was not for Avram's sake. It was not critically. In fact, for both Avram and Yitzchak, it was a liability. They nearly died for that, which they would not. It's not important to them. Okay. And they had the money. They could have had trophy wives because they had the cash. Okay? They elected not to have it. It's a very important point. In other words, it's very easy for a person who's got no money to say, yeah, I don't want a trophy wife there, Rabbi. Yeah, well, you know, that's not an option for you. You know, a guy like Tiger Woods who says no to a beautiful woman to have an affair, that's a very high level. A guy who's, putting on boxes at ShopRite and says, "Yeah, I'm not gonna have a trophy wife, dude. You're boxing groceries at ShopRite. That's not an option for you." So, but the key element is we don't. So the takeaway practically is we don't venerate good looks. We don't deprecate good looks. It has a instrumental value. It's valuable for a healthy relationship. It's value insofar as sharing the message of Torah, but it's not a good. If it's viewed as an absolute good, as we say in Eshet Chayil, it's sheker. It's superficial. It's false. It's hevel. It's nothingness. And conversely, and you know that empirically, relations that are only based on physical attraction will not last, because physical attraction wears off. And if you got nothing else, that relationship's going to be, as Suzanne said, attraction goes, but dumb is forever. So, so there's a big truth to that. So when you guys are dating or with a significant other, yes, you got to be attracted. That's a non-negotiable, but the critical elements are the eternal values and virtues of the person, which are kindness, compassion, honesty, integrity. You know, those are the qualities you're looking for. That's the stuff that lasts. Those are the real virtues that are of value. But you're not supposed to say that I have to be a tzaddik and not be concerned about the looks. You need the looks. They have an instrumental value, okay? Both before marriage and during marriage, okay? All right. Any questions?
I have a question.
All right, Sean.
Well, question and a comment. My comment is just a follow-up to what you were saying about the takeaway for us and Shidduchim and in general population. This reminds us of something that I learned from Rebbetzin Youngreis.
Aleha Shalom. A blessed memory, right. Yes.
He mentioned that, like, basically beauty is like, it was like, represents like our zeros. However, combined with good midot, it's like a multiplier effect. When you have good midot and good looks, like the zeros from that the looks are by itself makes it like a multiplier effect for the whole equation.
Well said. Well said.
And my question is relating to our whole discussion tonight. Two Haftorahs ago, there was a story about King David.
Yes.
When he said that he basically, at the very beginning of that Haftorah, said he was very old and like weak, and they brought to him like very attractive
Avishag
to warm him up.
Yes.
How does that whole story kind of, in the context of our discussion, how would you explain that? Like, why do you need these young women that were attractive just to warm him up?
That's a very good question. I don't know if I can do that justice in 30 seconds or less. Because he didn't sleep with her. The Torah, the Navi says he didn't sleep with her. All right, so that's a complex story. It's a good question. I don't want to try to give a 25-cent answer to a $5 question. So Let's hold that question. It's a good one.
All right. Just revisit that.
To be revisited.
Thought here, we started off with Thanksgiving and talking about Thanksgiving get-togethers, and we can kind of imagine the patriarchs getting together for Thanksgiving and what problems they would have at the Thanksgiving table. You know, with Yaakov and Esau and Yosef and his brothers going a little bit further down the line there.
Yes.
And Ishmael and Yitzhak, you know, just the whole dynamic of the patriarchs. There were obviously some family issues.
Yes, that is fair to say. We've discussed on many occasions some of the family dynamics. When we get into the later part of Bereshit, when we get to Yosef and the brothers, where you have clearly a dysfunction, we'll go into that more deeply. But excellent point there, Marvin. All right, guys, I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. For those of my senior fellowship class, we'll be having a Q&A on Zoom tomorrow night. Catch you later, everyone. Lalto.
Thanks, Rabbi.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Rabbi.
All the best.